Good afternoon. The grand old frigate USS Constitution, which you can see any day at the Boston Navy Yard, has unquestionably the most exciting and varied history of any ship afloat. Books by the dozen have dealt with her victorious exploits, and her brave commanders have been immortalized in song and story. One unusual event is not as well known as it might be, and that incident is the subject of today's Yankee Yarn. When all Ironsides came into the new Navy dry dock to be overhauled back in 1834, the commandant of the yard, Jesse Duncan Elliott, did something unpardonable. He caused a bigger-than-life-size statue of the President of the United States, Andrew Jackson, to be carved and mounted on the Constitution as a figurehead. Now, Elliott was as unpopular at the Charlestown Navy Yard as Jackson was everywhere else in New England, and the sober citizens of Boston, then mostly Republicans, bitterly resented the placing of a living president's image on their beloved old fighting ship. But Elliott was boss of the Navy Yard, and the Jackson figurehead, carved by Mr. Laban S. Beecher, was made and put up. But to satisfy the rabble, as he called his Republican critics, Elliott had three small heads of Hull, Bainbridge, and Stewart affixed to the stern of old Ironsides. And don't think for a minute that act didn't cause a lot of talk and criticism. From what I read in old records, newspapers, and history books, several offers were made to anyone who would remove the objectionable figurehead of Jackson. And it was common talk around town that Old Hickory ain't going to be on old Ironsides very long. Well, all this gossip reached the ears of Commodore Elliott, and fearing for the safety of his idol, he had guards posted on old Ironsides and the other two ships anchored nearby. He ordered a special marine guard to patrol all during the night, and strong light shone directly on the glowering features of the 10-foot figure of President Jackson. Well, just before the reconditioned Constitution was taken out of dry dock and made ready to sail to New York, there was a celebration, sort of a recommissioning party. And among the hundreds who attended was a young Cape Cod captain by the name of Charles Worthington Dewey. His father, a brave old captain in the 3rd Artillery, had instilled in his 28-year-old son some strong Republican ideas. And he had taken the lad, when he was a boy, to Fort Warren, from the ramparts of which they had watched the doomed Chesapeake lift her anchor and sail forth to fight the Shannon. They had heard the sound of cannon fire as it echoed over Boston Bay, and they had shared in the anguish which everyone felt at the fatal result of that naval engagement. So we can understand that this father and son, and thousands like them, regarded old Ironsides as something far too sacred to be despoiled by political shenanigans. To put any living man's image on a fighting ship was against all rules and custom, and the 10-foot figure of the unpopular Democratic President Jackson was more than the Cape Codder could stomach. On July 1st, 1834, old Ironsides was moored with her head to the west between the 274s, the Columbus, and Independence. And all three ships were alerted to be on the lookout for any suspicious acting person who might be bent on molesting the figurehead. On the night of July the 2nd, there was a ring-tail peeler of a thunderstorm. Rain fell in torrents, thunder boomed and reverberated, and lightning played around the tall masts and rigging of the ships in the Navy Yard. All this was advantageous to Charles Worthington Dewey from Falmouth, Massachusetts. He was just back from a trip to the West Indies for the firm of Henry and William Lincoln. And he'd heard one of the partners say, "You know, I'd gladly pay $100 if somebody would get into Navy Yard and cut off Jackson's head." So Samuel Dewey, always anxious to make an extra dollar, went over to the yard, looked around, came back and drawled, "I guess I can get the head for you, sir." The deal was made. And that night, with his oars muffled with a wooden woolen comforter, Dewey rowed out from Billy Gray's wharf in Boston and crossed the harbor to the Navy Yard. Reaching the side of the Independence, he worked his way in the driving rain under her black hull, which helped to shield him from sight. Reaching the Constitution, he made the painter fast, and then timing his movements as best as he could between the vivid flashes of lightning, Dewey climbed up the man ropes to the headboards, and inching himself along on his back, he took the saw that he'd brought along and began to cut off the head. From time to time, as he saw it, he could see the sentries looking straight at him. But for some reason, probably the rain, they didn't notice what was going on. And he made good progress until his saw struck a copper bolt. Then he moved his saw up higher and tackled the chin. When he'd worked the head loose and got it off, he dropped it into a bag, made his way down the man ropes, only to find his dory filled with rainwater. He'd left it right under the scuppers, and water gushing from the deck had practically filled it. Now he had to bail, and he thought sure he'd be discovered by the Marine Patrol. But he wasn't, and as soon as he could, Dewey sculled back through the darkness to Billy Gray's wharf. Drenched to the skin, he took his prize to his mother's house on School Street and hid it in the woodshed. Then he hung his boots on the clothesline and went to bed. When the decapitation was discovered the next morning and all Boston was agog with excitement, Mrs. Dewey, being slightly suspicious, went out in the yard and looked at her boy's boots. Gingerly, she stuck out her tongue, and tasting salt, she felt pretty sure it had been her son Sammy who'd operated on the president. The Democrats around Boston raised such a terrific hullabaloo over the incident, Dewey got scared. And placing the head in the champagne basket, he lugged it over to Henry Williams' house and collected his $100. Immediately, a few trusted Whigs were let into the secret, and that night, a very hush-hush party was arranged at a local coffee house. Toast after toast was offered to the unusual centerpiece, the head of Andy Jackson, resting, if you please, on a big pewter platter. A few days later, the prize was taken secretly to New York, and at a mass meeting of loyal Republicans, with Daniel Webster presiding, the president's head was again toasted at one of the most celebrated dinners ever staged in the old Astor House. From New York, the head was carted to Philadelphia, and so it went, until finally it was given back to Samuel Dewey, who had removed it from the Constitution. Whatever possessed Dewey to take that sad and battered wooden head to the national capital, I don't know. But he did, stopping en route to display the souvenir to any and all who wanted to touch it for luck and have a good chuckle. Arriving at Washington, Dewey went to the White House and asked to see the president. But Jackson was ill, so Mr. Dewey called on the vice president, Martin Van Buren, who politely asked what the stranger wanted. "I," said the Cape Codder, "am the person who cut off the president's head. I've got it here in this bag, and I want to return it." Van Buren was puzzled until he realized that it was the figurehead Dewey was talking about. And when he'd heard enough of the story to be convinced, he said tartly, "That thing belongs in the Navy Department. Take it over to Secretary Dickerson." So Sammy trotted over to the Navy Department with Jackson's wooden head still in the bag. That morning, Mr. Marlon Dickerson wasn't in a happy mood. He barely glanced at Dewey as he came in and said gruffly, "Yes? State your business, young man, and be brief. I'm busy." Dewey reached into the bag, took out the president's head, and slapped it down on a pile of papers right under the Secretary of the Navy's nose, causing Mr. Dickerson to almost choke. "You," he gulped. "That's right, sir, I did it, and I've brought it back because it's government property. If you'll give me a receipt for it, I'll be on my way. You seem to be busy." "A receipt? Huh, I'll give you more than that, young man. I'm having you placed under arrest." And he thrust a shaking hand toward the bell on his desk. "Wait a minute," said Dewey. "You can't arrest me. I've looked up the law. I can only be sued for trespass and in the county where the offense was committed. Say the word and I'll gladly go back to Boston and await trial. But," and he gave the naval officer a thin Yankee grin, "if a Middlesex County jury don't set me free in 5 minutes and give me a handsome reward for what I did, my name's not Dewey." Dickerson, an able lawyer himself, knew the young man was right. There was no law at that time against defacing Navy ships. So he pulled out a pad of paper and said, "All right, son, tell me all about it." Dewey walked out of the Navy Department that day a free man, and no charge of any kind was ever brought against him. Secretary Dickerson dispatched an order immediately to the Charlestown Navy Yard that the headless figurehead was to be covered with canvas when the Constitution left Boston for New York. And there, according to Navy records, a new head was bolted onto the shoulders. And in March 1835, Old Ironsides sailed for France. Some historians claim the new head was in reality the original which Dewey had left in Washington. Others say not. But what's most puzzling is that many years after, two complete statues of Andrew Jackson, both claimed to be from the Constitution, came to light and were for years on public exhibition. And furthermore, you can see both of them today. The first figurehead showed up at the Philadelphia Navy Yard when Old Ironsides put in there in 1874 to be overhauled. When the yard was abandoned, the statue was turned over to the Naval Museum at Annapolis. And to the best of my knowledge, it's been down there in Maryland ever since. I know it's there today. However, I imagine there are plenty of people living in the vicinity of Lowell, Massachusetts, who can remember going as children to Willowdale, the small amusement park at Miscupic Lake, and seeing a solid 10-foot statue of Old Hickory mounted on a granite boulder. Maybe they read the printed cards and the framed clippings, which would seem to prove that this statue of Jackson was the identical figurehead that young Dewey had decapitated. On July 1st, 1861, the Lowell Citizen printed a story that Jonathan Bowers, the proprietor of Willowdale Park, was about to unveil an unusual attraction, the Constitution's figurehead of Jackson. After the form was mutilated, the Lowell newspaper said, it was stored in a Boston sail loft, where it remained for 27 years until Mr. Bowers found it. Bowers had a new head carved, and this rare historic relic, which caused a national uproar, is bound to attract thousands to the picnic grounds in Tingsboro. When questioned about his acquisition, Bowers explained he'd found the figurehead in the woodworking shop of J.D. Fowle on Commercial Street and had paid $800 for the headless body. If anyone mentioned that another statue of Jackson was on exhibition down at the Naval Museum at Annapolis, Bowers would scoff, "It can't be. The figure down there is all in one piece. This one of mine had a detachable head. I know, because I had the head made and bolted it on myself." Now then, in April 1924, long after old Mr. Bowers had passed away, an agent for Henry Ford appeared at Willowdale, and so the story goes, offered $10,000 for the Constitution's figurehead. As the heirs had to agree to the sale, it took a few days to round them up, and the news of Henry Ford's offer got into the Boston papers. Then, a fashionably dressed stranger in a big black limousine arrived at Willowdale and topped Mr. Ford's offer. The weather-beaten statue disappeared, only to show up years later in a bookstore window over in New York. Now, according to a letter I received a few days ago from the curator, that same figure is now on loan at the Marine Museum in New York. Thinking I should also check with the Naval Academy at Annapolis, I wrote the director on September the 20th, 1950, and got a letter back which said, "The admiral who knows about this is away." Then on February 5th of this year, I received a letter from the newly appointed assistant director of the Naval Museum, saying, "Your request for information regarding the figurehead of the Constitution covers a subject far too controversial to be covered in this letter. You can, however, find the whole story in volume 53, number 297 of the Naval Proceedings." So I went to my good friend Ernest Dodge of the Peabody Museum in Salem and borrowed his copy of the Naval Proceedings. But after perusing it, I must confess, I now know less than I did before. I am certain, however, that folks around Boston didn't want Jackson's image on old Ironsides, and that Captain Dewey obliged them by cutting off the head. But why there are two of these famous figureheads, I don't know. And by the looks of things, I don't think I'm ever going to find out.